You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
So my conversation with Nate ran way longer than I thought it would, which is great. Because what I've decided to do in the interest of keeping episodes shorter is to split it into two parts. So part two will really be all about our discussion of LeBron James and Michael Jordan. And today, in part one, Nate and I discuss trends in the league and Steph Curry. Hope you guys enjoy. Thinking Basketball Podcast, my name is Ben, and today a very, very special episode. It's my first guest on this young podcast, and I think a very fitting guest. I've done his show twice now. He has one of the most popular basketball podcasts on the web. Mr. Nate Duncan, thanks for coming
by. Hey, my pleasure. I mean, we had so much more stuff that we have to get to. After your last appearance on my show, I've been foaming at the mouth for this.
Yeah, it's really, we've been talking offline a little bit about how to construct it, because it feels like if you haven't heard my appearances on Dunked On, this is really just a continuation of that. It's less of like me having a guest on and talking to him, and more of we're gonna jump back into the historical discussions. And I think really today the main focus that we'll get to is going to be this LeBron versus Jordan conversation that we tabled from last time. But I think we can segue into it with a few other stuff that we had to table.
Yeah, it sounds good. Let's get started.
Awesome. So one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about before we go to all the historical conversations, you just finished up your seasonal over-unders that you and Danny do on Dunked On. And this is a discussion that I've had on Twitter now briefly, and it's just something that's been rolling around in my mind, which is this movement toward maybe a little bit more parity in terms of top teams, maybe bottom teams getting better. And so as you guys go through those over-unders, you had a lot of unders on teams that had high lines, and even the teams that had high lines where you guys were like, okay, they might go over. There wasn't a lot of discussion of 62, 65, 67 wins. It came to my attention that the last time a team didn't hit 60 wins in the NBA was 2004, when Minnesota had 58. And that's actually the lowest number in the three-point era. So I'm wondering, you know, where do you stand on this idea that maybe we're going to see a little bit more parity this year? Maybe the top teams won't be running away with 65 wins.
Yeah, I think there just isn't an individual team that looks that good. You know, the Warriors, given where they are, number one, with this now being the fifth year of this run for many of their guys, certainly their core guys, with the already Draymond Green suffering minor injuries again, the fact that they just didn't address any weakness in a game that Steph Curry doesn't play. So, I mean, I think they're almost a 500 team without him, even though they have more talent. I think the pieces actually fit together extremely poorly offensively when he's not there. So that's part of it. I think with DeMarcus Cousins out, their big man depth, especially if they're going to insist on playing Jones and Jerebko, is going to be a big problem too. And Kevin Durant doesn't exactly look like it's preseason, but he doesn't exactly look like he's locked in playing hard. But also they didn't get the number one seed last year and they won anyway. And right. So that's always another reason. We've seen this with these Cleveland teams too, where, you know, once you win without getting the number one seed, there's like, we can, we don't need home court. You know, let's just kind of take it easy. So I think there's that aspect to it as well. I think the other aspect to it is, well, and I picked the Warriors for 62 wins. I think they might still get to 60 if Curry plays enough games, but if not, you know, I don't think they will. And the preseason has not been particularly encouraging from my standpoint. And then I think you're also just generally, while there does seem to be a team that gets to 60 wins, even sometimes surprise teams like the Raptors almost got there last year. You could look at like the Hawks in 2015, those sorts of teams. You're probably always better off betting against any individual team getting to 60 wins, unless it's just like you're thinking before the season, this team is a historical juggernaut. And I don't see that with any of these teams this year.
Right. So was Golden State your high total? At
yes.
62?
Yeah, I think I've got the Rockets at either like 58 or 59. Let me get my prediction sheet up here. But which, of course, once I get that out, those are completely infallible. So take those as gospel, please.
Well, you're pulling those up. So one of the directions that I've been thinking of this from is we've had a big influx of quality players in the last couple rookie drafts. And this rookie class, again, looks like it's going to be a serious sort of block of contributors. And I think when you couple that with the fact that teams, you know, it's copycat league, right? So teams are catching up. They're understanding how to play Morey Ball more. They're understanding how to use spacing. We're now seeing pace coming back. I think when you put all those things together, to me, you kind of have a recipe for something that deviates from the like, okay, the number one team is 65, the number two team is 62, and, you know, we've got teams winning 12 games at the bottom of the tankathon or something like that. I just don't think we're going to see a season like that.
Yeah, I think so, and especially at the end of last year when you had so many teams that were really trying to get into the last year of the old lottery system and just all clustered around one another as well, although clustered around one another kind of in the 22 to 27 win range. You know, I do think we'll see some team get hit with injuries and be unexpectedly bad. But yeah, it doesn't seem like there are teams that are just going to be, you know, I'm not picking anyone to be like below 20 wins or anything like that. Although I will say that when teams do decide to go for the tank these days, they are much more brazen, I mean, than really at any time in the lottery era. I know there was, you know, back in like the early 80s, before the lottery system, teams were really like losing games intentionally, and that's why the lottery system came in. But I think now, because of the two-way contracts as well in the last month of the season, and now you can play guys 13 through 17 on your roster instead of guys 11 through 15, yeah. That like you could really make sure that there are no good players out there. So there, I think there is the ability to really tank down the end. But I thought that the teams that really benefited from that last year were kind of the mid-range teams in the West, where you had to get 47 wins to get into the playoffs. And even the East as well, we saw all the playoff teams over 500, which you don't always see.
Another thing I wanted to get to that we sort of discussed offline and didn't touch on in our last installment was the idea of defensive and offensive asymmetries. Now we did discuss this at the high end, right? We said that the best offensive players are generally going to be able to have a larger impact than the best defensive players. And you know, we can discuss how historically the interior defender sort of archetype may have had larger impact than he can have today with the game so spread out. But you had an interesting point that we didn't get to last time, which was about the bottom end. What happens when you struggle on offense or you struggle on defense? Do you want to chime in with your theory?
Yeah,
on
I think that the worst offensive players are a lot worse than the worst defensive players. And a couple thoughts there. I think if you look at like ESPN's RPM, the absolute best players in the league usually have like a more extreme offensive RPM than the best defensive players do. And then same thing, I think, you know, you'll see that the best offensive RPM players seem to be, you know, more extreme there than you see the worst offensive or defensive RPM players. So that gives me an idea. One thought, at least statistically, I'm not the most rigorous statistical analyst there, but anecdotally, I think there's a couple reasons for that also. One is, well, let me ask you this, if so you agree with this. This is my theory that hiding a bad defensive player in today's game is more easily accomplished than hiding a bad offensive player.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's the area that I agree with. I don't know if I can easily detect an asymmetry there. And that's why I thought it might be interesting for us to discuss before we dive into the historical stuff. Because if you, so I looked at, say like the last 20 years of adjusted plus minus data, and the bottom, let's go through the bottom X, right? The bottom 10 players on average have about the same, they're like minus four, if you will, offense and defense. Bottom 50 are about the same. They're like minus 3.5. Bottom 100, the same. Bottom 500. So to me, what I'm looking at there is you can hide guys on offense and you can hide guys on defense, but I'm not sure if I can see an argument where you can, for lack of a better way to phrase it, better hide someone, if you will. That was the worst English ever, but you know what I mean.
A couple of points there. One, I think it's very likely due to the way that everyone skews in favor of offense, despite what coaches ostensibly preach, is there's probably selection bias there, right? If you're that bad of an offensive player to where, you would just have, an incredibly negative adjusted plus minus on offense, you probably just don't even make the league to begin with, right? Like, or you just, the coach is like, this guy just looks so ridiculous out here trying to play offense, we're just not even going to play this guy. Whereas on defense, especially if you're doing well offensively, coaches will always find a way, if a guy's a good offensive player, to get him on the floor, unless it's just, the most extreme playoff crucible. And teams just in general, your regular season 30 teams have enough trouble scoring that if you can score, no matter how bad you are defensively, like, you're going to get playing time on most teams. So I think that's part of it. The other part, if you just think about it schematically, right? Like, if you have a bad defender, okay, what can you do? Well, you can put him on the worst offensive player. All right, certainly, especially again in the playoffs, they'll really go after that guy, force him to guard the ball with small pick and rolls, et cetera. But then you can still help that guy, right? Like, you can bring guys over, you can double team, you can bring guys into help position, you can try to rotate behind the ball, you can try to switch him out. There's all these things that you can do schematically. Whereas if a guy just can't score, well, you could say, okay, well, what's the equivalent of hiding him defensively? Well, okay, we're going to not give him the ball. Well, that doesn't really help much, because now his guy, especially under the new rules, I think this has changed a lot in the last 20 years, because with increased scouting, but also just now that you can play zone, you just not guard that guy. And so there are a few things schematically that you can do. And I think we saw, like, for example, the Warriors start working on some of these in last year's conference finals. But I think it's much harder to just make a guy be guarded who has no offensive skill than it is to hide a guy who has no defensive skill. And then the last point I'd make, too, is, like, if you had the worst offensive player in the league try to score against an average defender versus if you had the best offensive player in the league try to score against an average defender. Is that how I want to say it? Yeah.
I kind of get what you're saying.
The worst offensive player in the league just isn't going to score against anyone, right? Whereas the worst defensive player in the league, he's going to at least provide, like, some resistance. I think there's just, like, if you just look at the skill set, like Omer Asik trying to score one-on-one in the post versus, Doug McDermott trying to guard LeBron James one-on-one in the post. I like Doug McDermott a little bit better there, even if, it's still not great.
So, okay, that's interesting. I think now we're getting somewhere on this. The first, a couple thoughts. First, I think the idea that I'm with you on this. I think the idea that the worst offensive players out there sort of aren't really seeing the court in this league. And I think it's because of that selection bias that I'm comfortable making statements like, I'm not sure when you actually get to the game, there's a significant asymmetry. With that said, you touched on last year's playoffs, and I know that's something that you've mentioned before. Let's talk a little bit more about this idea where when you get to the postseason, there's a mismatch hunting concept that's starting to become very popular. It was, of course, all the discussion in the conference finals last year with the Rockets and the Warriors. But do you think that adds to this point you're making where nowadays, maybe not, certainly not 40 years ago, maybe not even 15 or 20 years ago, but in today's game, there's a vulnerability that's larger with a weak defensive piece out there that kind of is exposed in the postseason when you get to game plan.
That's tough to say. I mean, you might, with all the historical film that you've watched, you might be more qualified to answer this than I am, because I haven't really gone back and watched a ton of historical games recently. You know, I don't remember the prevalence of, say, the small pick and roll to get, like, the worst player onto, you know, your star. That, I think...
Well, they're certainly switching more now. So, I think the thrust of my question is even about what's happened in the last couple of years, because I just see this thought out there that, you know, you can defenses switch and you can mismatch Hunt, and therefore Carmelo Anthony maybe is a good example. Not that I've ever rushed to his defense, but there's an idea that if you put him on the court, they're going to find him and expose him, and that's going to massively spike offensive efficiency. And I'm not sure I'm sold yet on that being the future wave of basketball.
Yeah, and there are always counters that are going to emerge. And I think these new rules as well, how that fits into the switching. I think part of like the competition committee probably didn't like the number of ISOs that had to happen in that Golden State-Houston series, and a lot of that I think was because when they would switch and guys would try to cut, they would just get held, or, you know, the screening action really became less effective because of that. So they really are focusing in. So, you know, I think that a lot of that mismatch happening or hunting happens because your conventional stuff isn't working as well. You know, I don't know that coaches really love doing that type of stuff. I think, yeah.
Well, you can induce it, too. I thought Houston did that well last year, right? They'd switch Harden onto a big, and Harden's value as a post defender certainly isn't much worse than his value as a perimeter defender, and they would just induce these Taj Gibson post-ups all the time, and it's like, that's maybe not what you want to do.
And I think that's an important distinction. The Wolves in particular won it, and I thought that Houston not only did a great job of switching, but then they did a great job of loading up on those ISOs. And then when you look at how effective Houston was when teams would switch, then what's the difference between Houston and Minnesota? Well, Houston's spreading the floor. You know, you've talked about this, how, you know, James Harden is just this supercharged 30-point 10 assist guy that, you know, really just couldn't exist in previous eras. And part of that is just due to the philosophy of, hey, we're going to spread the floor and let this guy go to work. And so now all of a sudden, if you've got the floor spread, isolation basketball maybe can become more efficient because you can't stay in front of the guy and then you have to help. And now you're giving up an open three pointer. Whereas if you're, say, a team in 2010 or the 2018 Minnesota Timberwolves, you just don't have enough spacing to make that isolation play effective, even if the guy at the point of attack isn't the strongest defender.
Right. So I think we're close to segueing back into how this applies to historical players. So this is good, but I think the final point, to close the loop maybe here on this, is to say that everything that you just described, you still need an engine like Harden or LeBron or maybe a handful of other players to kind of to run that system effectively. So even though it's something that was focused and under a spotlight in last year's playoffs, I'm not convinced that that's the future direction of offense as we move forward with this pace and space, Morey ball kind of trend that we've seen in the last few years.
Well, yeah, I mean, and again, this is something that we wanted to talk about too, is that, you know, is it just a totally different game when you get into the Final Four? Where, because playing conventionally, I mean, Utah did a pretty decent job against Houston, but most teams playing conventionally, I mean, maybe if you have, you know, the absolute best rim protector in the NBA, you can get away with this, or you have a great system like the Spurs, but generally you're not going to be able to stop a Houston or a Golden State really with a conventional system. And so, you know, you're getting into these matchups where the teams all have enough shooting and enough superstars on one hand, and then defensively they have the personnel to switch everything on the other end. And that's just such a powerful combination that if you don't have both of those things, you're really just not a serious championship contender. And so that there are maybe three or four teams in the league, you know, if you look at this year, Houston, Golden State, Boston, maybe Toronto, you know, those are probably the four teams you would look at that fall into that category. We'll see how the Lakers end up, but they're probably a little bit below there, especially on the shooting standpoint. And so if you have all those things, you're just playing a completely different game than the rest of the NBA. It seems like that to me. And the question I wanted to ask you on the show previews we didn't get to is, you know, is from a stylistic standpoint, from a talent standpoint, was that true in previous eras where really the conference finals and the finals look different than the first round or a regular season game in terms of style, in terms of talent, or is that a relatively recent invention?
Well, first, I hope you don't get too much hate mail from Philadelphia for leaving them out of the potential Final Four candidates.
Well, I mean, maybe they get there, but they're not going to get there by playing the sort of spacing, switching style with great creators that I was talking about. I mean, they will have to do it a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. To answer the question, I don't think as much changed back then, whether it was 15 or 20 years ago or 40 years ago, as we see today. But I'm definitely interested. So to connect this back to my all-time player series, the way I approach regular season versus playoffs, forget the Final Four for a second, just that transition. When you get into the playoffs, to me, there are a couple huge differences that occur from the regular season. The first, of course, is you get to game plan for someone. You get to be tactical about how you attack vulnerabilities on the same team throughout a series. The second is you play the same team. Your sample sizes are like N equals one or N equals two. You just play the same team and run it back. And when you run it back, there's these natural learning curves. So, you know, you start with strategy, then you have a counter, then you have a counter to the counter, et cetera, et cetera. And so with certain players, not much changes because they can handle counters. Their game is, I've described it as robust before, right? Like it's pretty hard to take away. With other guys, there's an ability to take certain things away. I think Karl Malone was a guy I highlighted in that situation. And then certain players, their just game is so rich that they seem to thrive in those situations. So the point I'm making here and want you to weigh in on is the regular season to the playoffs doesn't even always have that big of a shift outside of those two factors. But sometimes people will ramp up a little bit. Sometimes people will ramp down. And I think that concept holds true for teams, right? Like if you look at a team's regular season performance, it's generally predictive of the playoffs. Some are going to be a little better than the indicators and some a little worse, probably for those same reasons, cough, cough, the Utah Jazz and Jerry Sloan.
Yeah. And, you know, if you have a very intricate system, I think that you're relying on, you know, I always call them system buckets, right? Where you're getting a guy a wide open layup essentially because you're fooling the defense, right? And so, or because you're just executing so well. But, you know, a lot of it just comes down to just not being prepared and being surprised. And in a playoff setting, especially as you get later into a series, those buckets become harder to come by. Now, maybe transition doesn't necessarily, you know, I mean, that's a way to still get easy buckets that's harder to control. But especially in the half court, you know, and even Golden State, you'll see, you know, when they run their split cut action and they get backdoor layups and just, you know, buckets that occur because of good offense, but also, you know, there's a component of a defensive mistake in there. Those seem less prevalent as you get into the playoffs and then certainly deeper into a playoff series.
So let's use that as a springboard to talk about someone like Steph Curry, where in your opinion, do you think that when you get to the playoffs, he's getting fewer easy buckets or maybe more germane, he's generating fewer easy buckets with his gravity, misdirection, and creation than in the regular season? Because I'm not sure at first blush from a distance that it seems like there's that much of a difference. What do you think?
Well, so much of this comes down to the health as well, right? If you look at the 2016 playoffs, the 2016 finals, where you know he didn't play nearly at the level as he did in that 2016 regular season, you know that certainly there's an element of that. Again, last year it wasn't at his best in that Rocket series, although in Game 7, obviously he was awesome. I think there is a component where just going later into the playoffs against better defensive teams that because they have the ability to switch, I mean, you really just can't guard Steph Curry. I mean, the Celtics, maybe when they had Avery Bradley and Marcus Smart, was the closest we've seen a team come to actually guarding him conventionally and succeeding. But unless you have the personnel to switch well and the discipline to switch well, you're probably not going to be able to stop Steph Curry at full health. And so, yeah, you do take away a little of that stuff, but I think his playoff performance and his team's playoff performance generally has been very good, with the caveat that I think, you know, this is just subjective. I haven't done the math on this, but that he is subject, just because he makes so many spectacular plays and takes so many difficult, crazy shots, and you know, we'll get in the lane. He's got this kind of magic component to his game where you're like, oh man, I can't believe that he's doing this type of stuff that no one else is doing. Well, when he fails at that, it's just so memorable, or he'll have like some really bad shooting games. And like, there's this feeling of like, oh wait, the magic is over, right? Like, you, even now in the 30s, when he can just look so bad sometimes when it's not working for him, that I think that that really sticks with people. Because, and then just the almost like how unreal it is when he's going well, you're just like, oh, this can't continue. Nobody else plays like this. Like, everyone is just, you know, primed, it seems like, for the regression. And then if it comes in a couple of games, you know, I mean, like that 2015 finals, for example, you know, he really only had one terrible game, which was game two, where he's like, you know, 5 out of 23 right, or something. But everyone remembered that. And then he should have been the MVP of that series, and he wasn't, because I think that, you know, the narrative happened early in the series of, oh, you know, he's playing really poorly. And then they switched Iguodala into the starting lineup. And so it was like, oh, well, he must have been the difference. And that's why we're going to make him the MVP.
So I've said this before, and I'll reiterate it here so we can dive in on it. 2016 Steph Curry, before the injury, the level he was playing at in the regular season, that to me was up there with the all-time greatest peaks for a single season in NBA history, possibly exceeding or certainly challenging, I would say 2000 Shaq, and pick your favorite season from Michael Jordan and LeBron. Is that, am I leaving anyone else out of that discussion? And does that sound far-fetched to you in terms of Curry, the way he was playing before the injury?
Well, I think there are some who would say some of those Wilt seasons, but I think your research has somewhat debunked how good of an offensive player he was, just because his teams just weren't that good offensively, and he wasn't really creating for anyone else. You know, the Adrian Dantley disease, kind of, where his numbers look really efficient and he has high usage, but his team just, you know, isn't scoring that well. In terms of a regular season, yeah, you know, I think I would have to say that, you know, especially when you throw in how clutch he was, you know, it, just in terms of the value created, like, I think that's something that, you know, may not be repeatable, but did happen that season. You know, they got to 73 wins on the back of him doing that stuff late in games. But yeah, I mean, I think that may be the greatest offensive season of all time. Certainly, you know, Shaq playing at an actual motivated level, LeBron, Jordan provided more defensively than Curry. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the best offensive season of my lifetime, especially because, you know, they didn't really have like that much else offensively on that team, and they're still killing people. And then you see what happens when he goes off the floor and like it all falls apart for them. I mean, that's basically been the case for his entire career.
Right. I'm not sure that's the element that the general public realizes. Like, when he goes off the court, they're not terrible, but there's not a lot of magic happening. And when he's on the court, you're talking about some of the greatest offenses of all time. I sort of conjured him up in a hypothetical years ago before he existed, because when we talked about, you know, Shaq and he was only a 50% free throw shooter, or how would Jordan do if you gave him more possessions and a 3-point shot, you start to get into a math game, right? Like, adding 20% to Shaq's free throw percentage gets him X number of points more. And so the hypothetical I used to always come up with, it was like, let's say there's a short guy who does nothing but shoot threes from 35 feet and he hits him at like 50% and he takes like 15 a game. You're talking about a guy who, all other things being equal, would be the most valuable player ever. And that's kind of what 2016 Steph Curry turned into. He like led the league in scoring rate and scoring efficiency. It was mathematically kind of breaking the game.
Yeah, and it was unbelievable late in games. And, you know, his team, the offense when he was on the floor was just unbelievable too. I mean, that's always the other component too, is like, how's the team playing, as you've highlighted. So yeah, I mean, I would put him in that category. Again, though, you know, if you just go and watch his like highlights from that season, and you do wonder a little bit of like, okay, was this just a hot streak? You know, something we talked about the other day, was well, you know, what is your standard really for measuring the greatest of all time, right? And it seems like for a lot of people, it's did it long enough that it wasn't a fluke, and then how good were you over that period, you know? And so I think right. that probably isn't long enough. Whereas Shaq, it was like, okay, he was this good in 2000, and, you know, that's because he was in shape, but he clearly had the talent to get there. He just had to get in shape. So it wasn't a fluke. You know, he's just dunking everything around the rim. You know, there's you can't say that's lucky, you know, the way you can with just bombing these absolutely ridiculous three-pointers the way Curry was. And really, I don't think, you know, while he has flashes of that every now and then, I mean, just the fact, like, you know, what did he make? Like, 5 or 6 shots from, like, half court or more in that season? And, you know, I think he's made maybe, like, 1 or 2 since then. You know, just, like little things like that. Just the magic of that season, I think there is a fluke component to it. Although certainly, you know, some of his numbers in the seasons around there are close, at least in terms of his on-off impact, but not quite, you know, to the individual level that he had that year, and certainly not making just the ridiculous, like, memorable shots that he made that year either.
Well, that's, yeah, I think that's an element worth discussing. He, I can't remember the exact stat, but he had, they tracked some, you know, outside of 27 feet or something like that. He was hitting like 60% of threes, and that is unsustainable to a degree. So you can call that fluky. But my contention, and this has been really sort of overrun by Kevin Durant's arrival, my contention is that in 17, definitely last year for a while when he was healthy, in 18, and even his play in 2015, like this is top of the league kind of stuff. And yet, as we briefly mentioned or discussed offline, like I feel like I'm out on an island saying that this guy's in contention for the best player in the league. You look at a lot of top 10 lists, they have him like 4th or 5th or, you know, something like that. And a lot of people think Kevin Durant is just clearly better. Where do you tend to come down on that debate?
There's a lot of components to it. I think Curry probably is better. You know, they certainly have performed better with Curry in the lineup and without Durant than vice versa over the last few years. Now, Durant would be the first to tell you, and he's correct about this, that the system is built around Steph Curry. That's true. But also then they just have never had any kind of decent personnel to replace him. I mean, they have never even had like another decent pick and roll point guard on the roster, you know, since, yeah. I mean, even going back to the Mark Jackson days. So the on off is always going to look better for him because they've been so flawed anytime he goes out. And that's going to be the case again this year as well. I think that because they have played the Cavaliers in the finals these 2 years, I think that Kevin Durant is a more valuable player against Cleveland due to his ability to guard LeBron okay at times, and the fact that Cleveland, you know, is pretty experienced dealing with Curry, you know, and that they really focused on taking him away a ton and didn't really focus on taking Durant away. And it's really tough to focus on taking Durant away given the way he plays. And so, you know, taking Curry away, that opens stuff up for everyone else, and the Warriors generally, except at the very end of that 2016 series, have scored quite well against Cleveland, with the exception of 2015. So I think that it's just set up for KD to look a lot better against Cleveland. But, you know, if you go back to most of these other series, I think Curry has generally been more valuable. Maybe you could make an argument in that Houston series, the other big one that they had, who was better. But Curry, again, was just coming off an injury. So that's maybe not entirely fair to him at that point. So, no, I do. If you had to say, who would you rather have on your team? I would say probably Steph Curry would still be the answer for me.
Okay, but that's a great point you just pointed out, I think, in terms of narrative development, right? Because Durant is, if you had Durant with no Curry, A, it's not guaranteed that team's going to roll through the playoffs and play Cleveland anyway. And B, the way Cleveland would attack Durant would be totally different than the team with Curry that rolls over everyone and then kind of like can turn to Durant as someone to showcase or specialize in certain matchups. And because that matchup keeps happening in the finals versus, you know, when everyone's looking and all the lights are on versus any of the other series or matchups that they could play, probably feeds into this idea. It's really strange to me that Golden State has 3 titles, 4 finals appearances, more wins than anyone ever. And yet people talk about the fact that Steph Curry has 0 final MVPs. So
yeah, although I think he probably should have won in 2015, and that would probably reduce that a little bit. But yeah.
Well, I think it should be a playoff MVP anyway. It's always frustrated me that they don't do that. It opens yourself up to picking someone who had like an incredible 3 series. You could pick a loser from the finals team. But 2, I think that's just more in the spirit of what people are interested in. Like, you have a 4-game sweep in 2007 and you give Tony Parker the finals MVP. What kind of historical significance does that convey about the season, the playoffs, or that team? I'm curious as to how you feel about that.
Yeah, well, I think the league just wants the finals to be a big deal, right? I mean, and they want it to be, okay, we're presenting this trophy afterwards. We want it to be a coronation for the guy who was just most recently good. Like, they don't want to, like, it just, from a storytelling standpoint, like, oh yeah, remember how good Tim Duncan was 2 rounds ago against the Suns in 2007. It's like, you know, it's not as interesting, right? And so a lot of people also just only tune in for the finals. And so it's like, wait, Tony Parker was way better than Tim Duncan in this series. Like, why is Duncan getting it? Like, I don't remember seeing that. You know, so I think it's just, it's just kind of easier. And then also, like, they definitely don't want it to be someone on a team that's not in the finals, number one, or from the losing team too. I mean, it's just like, all right, now let's go into the weeping losing locker room for the presentation of the finals MVP. Like, it just, the optics just don't work for that. I'm in agreement with you. If we want to actually measure things historically, I would much prefer to do it that way. But I think those are the reasons why it's unrealistic.
You don't miss the Jim Gray days of heading into the losing locker room with penetrating questions about how they feel.
No, I mean, they still kind of do that sometimes anyway, but it's just like, yeah, they're, it doesn't seem, things like that are all PR, you know, more than it is like, oh, let's look back in 30 years. I mean, the, you know, the All-Star team is the same way. There's a ton of things like which, you know, I wish were, it was just acknowledged that that was the purpose and that we could, you know, divorce ourselves from the fact that Joe Johnson, you know, made 8 All-Star teams when we're talking about his Hall of Fame candidacy because the East sucked during that time.
I'm going to need a minute to regroup after hearing about Joe Johnson making 8.
I don't remember how many it was, but it's around that number.
Oh, man. So that seems like a good place to stop. I still have not recovered from remembering that Joe Johnson made, he didn't actually make 8 All-Star teams. He made 7. But nonetheless, I've sought medical attention, and I think I'm going to be able to power through. So let's pause there. Part 2, I will release relatively soon. I got to edit it and get it up and everything like that. But that was part 1. If you guys enjoyed that, remember, all of these podcasts are really only made possible by patrons over at Patreon. It's patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. It's in the show notes. It's on my Twitter profile. If you want to contribute, you want to support. And I've worked on a bunch of other stuff over the summer that hopefully will be coming soon and made available to all you guys who support the show. It's very much appreciated. And until then, I will see you in the next episode. Hope you guys are having a great day.